Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. A little lake north of Pinedale has long been treasured by locals for fishing. But this fall, something happened.
It's just astonishing to me that now it's like this red-colored cesspool that cannot possibly contain populations of fish.
There's going to be an influx of new faces at the Wyoming Capitol this month after a slate of newcomers beat out incumbents in recent elections.
I'm not a politician. I'm not a public official. I'm a long-haired biker. I'm an introvert. I'm not made for this.
And we have the story of how a group of Green River High School students wrote a proclamation to make January 5th Nellie Taylor Ross Day.
Whereas 100 years ago, Nellie Taylor Ross, a trailblazer in American politics, made profound contributions to the advancement of women in leadership and public service.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. The deadline to sign up for healthcare on the Affordable Care Act marketplace is January 15th. A record 45,000 Wyomingites have signed up already. Some people will be able to find plans with monthly payments as low as $10. And United Healthcare is now the third company offering insurance in the state. I recently asked our region's director for U.S. Health and Human Services, Lily Griego, what's something new that Wyomingites should keep in mind when choosing a plan this year?
We have marketplace plans that are available as low as $10 a month. And that's really important. Folks can visit healthcare.gov. And we have this available in English and other languages as well. It gives consumers a place to do their own shopping if they prefer to look at it. What we do know is that folks are interested in making sure that they have access to a local doctor, a local healthcare provider, folks that they're familiar with. And so this gives folks an opportunity to search those plans to make sure that they can get what they need. I want to talk for just a minute about Wyoming having 211 as an option for Wyomingites to call in case they don't have health insurance, they don't know where to start. These are your neighbors who are familiar with what Wyomingites experience in terms of drive times, access to care. And we know that we're a really, really remote, rural state. That's the region that we serve here. And we want to make sure that folks are familiar with what they're going to get in terms of healthcare insurance or coverage in terms of the access to those providers that are on the ground.
Got it. And can you remind me who might want to be paying attention to this deadline? I know about 10% of Wyomingites don't have health insurance coverage.
Yeah. So to be very honest, everyone should be paying attention to the deadline. This is the one time during the calendar year that we're doing enrollment. We want to make sure that folks just have access to healthcare. That's been one of the top priorities that Secretary Becetta has talked about in this entire time that we've been in this administration. But not just having access to healthcare, access to affordable health insurance.
If I signed up on the marketplace last year, do I need to do anything to re-enroll?
Technically, no. What we would say is please revisit your plan. You know, did you have experiences last year where you visited that doctor for your kiddo who said, this is not an insurance I accept anymore? That's one of the concerns that I would have if I were in Wyoming and making sure that I had coverage through the marketplace or even through my employer. Do you have the needs met that you have last year? Do you have healthcare changes that have taken place? I can think of a myriad of issues that may come up that are unexpected health emergencies. And we want to make sure that your healthcare coverage is going to meet those either emergencies or changing family needs. And so that's a really good time to make sure that the plan you have is one that you're expecting to carry you through 2025.
You mentioned that folks might be able to find some really, really cheap premium plans this year, but a Kaiser Family Foundation analysis found Wyoming has some of the highest average benchmark premiums in the country at $871 a month. What would you say to people who hear those numbers and think, how am I going to afford health insurance?
This is why the marketplace is so important. Some plans right now on the marketplace have no copays. It's just really important to make sure that we're reviewing the plans as individuals and relying on the navigators to help us in these decision-making processes that come once a year through open enrollment. We have broken records through the Biden-Harris administration and made sure that folks across the entire country, to include Wyoming, are having access to healthcare providers. It's up to Congress to review some changes coming up in 2025. And one of those things is that tax premiums right now are life-saving and game-changing, according to Secretary Becerra. And we want to make sure that your folks in Congress are well-informed on the fact that plans that we have now have increased coverage, have increased the number of Americans with health insurance. And what we know is that that's game changer, according to the secretary, and it's also life-saving when people know that they have the freedom to walk into the doctor's office and the peace of mind to be able to say, yes, I have health insurance.
Those expanded tax credits that get those plans to have those $10 premiums, that's through the Inflation Reduction Act, which is set to expire at the end of this year. More and more Wyomingites are enrolling in Medicare. This is the federal health insurance program for people age 65 and up. Almost 18% of the state used the program last year. What changes to Medicare or how it's funded might you be anticipating under the incoming Trump administration and a Republican-led Congress?
One of the things that we want to celebrate is the historic steps that we've taken to lower prescription drug costs. During the past year, during 2024, the president negotiated through our department, lower drug prices for 10 of the most expensive prescription drugs that American seniors are using and that are life-saving. Some of these address diabetes issues, heart failure issues, some of the most common issues that our seniors face as they are aging and aging in place, to include folks in Wyoming. The reason that this is so important is that we are doing two things in 2025. Number one, we're continuing that work through the Inflation Reduction Act. But number two, we're beginning the drug price negotiation for the second set of drugs. And so we leave office January 20th with record numbers of folks covered, with the Inflation Reduction Act delivering on behalf of the American people. And we celebrate this work and we're leaving it in a good space for the Trump administration to continue this work.
The Wyoming legislature hasn't passed Medicaid expansion, which would help lower income folks access insurance. What other options are there?
This is something that we have been focused on in the Biden-Harris administration, is encouraging the states to pick up Medicaid expansion. To your east, the neighbors in South Dakota passed Medicaid expansion while I've been here in this position. And what I want to comment on this a little bit is to say thank you to Governor Gordon. He has done some tremendous work in the space, and he and his team and I have been in close communication as it relates to workforce issues, in particular in maternal health in the state of Wyoming. And also, we want to say thank you to the governor and his team and folks across the entire state of Wyoming who are focused on improving behavioral health for the state of Wyoming. The state legislature in Wyoming has had discussions in the last couple sessions to try and get Medicaid expansion. And what we have demonstrated at HHS through not only data, but reporting and conversations with governors, county commissioners, mayors, and the like, that people, when they have access to healthcare, will use that healthcare to seek health resources through a doctor, primary care doc, preventative medicine, telehealth resources. This strengthens your overall health of a community. What we also know is when your community is healthy, your economy is healthy.
Lily Griego, Regional Director for Health and Human Services covering Wyoming. Thank you so much for talking with me about signing up for our health insurance on the marketplace.
I appreciate your time on the subject. Thanks, Nikki. Happy New Year.
Grand Teton National Park bought the Kelly parcel from the state of Wyoming for $100 million just before the ball dropped on the new year. It's the culmination of decades of negotiation and political positioning that really ramped up in the past year. Now, with the money in state hands, the square mile of critical habitat for a variety of wildlife species is permanently protected. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Fulpula-Ankeny reports that with new owners, recreators, business owners, and environmental advocates alike are wondering what people will be able to do on the land and how the state will use its millions.
Susan Marsh doesn't plan her days. The 71-year-old wakes up and does what feels right. And what feels right many mornings is driving her baby blue Subaru Forester about half an hour from her home in Jackson to a square mile of smooth hills and rounded gullies across the Snake River from the Tetons, the Kelly Parcel.
I ski here, I hike, I look for wildflowers in the spring, animal tracks. There's a lot of aspen stands up here and they're beautiful in the spring and fall.
On a below freezing, slightly gusty and gray January morning, she straps on snowshoes, leans onto a single ski pole, and tromps to the top of a knoll.
Most of what you see on the north side of where we're standing is in the Kelly Parcel, as they call it. I think we need to come up with a better name for it, frankly, but it's not a parcel, it's a little Shangri-La. So let's call it that for right now.
The Kelly Parcel has been a tense subject for decades, but especially in the past year, as state electeds ironed out a deal most felt was fair. At one point, the state's land managers recommended auctioning the parcel to the highest bidder. That would have maxed out the money made off the land for the state's schools, but could have opened it up to private development. An open auction was met with scrutiny from thousands around the state, country, and world. And if the final sale had not closed before the 2025 legislative session, the state's hard right Freedom Caucus, which now holds a majority of the House in Cheyenne, could have overturned the deal. Some Freedom Caucus members say they want more from the feds to further oil and gas development in the southwest part of the state, helping the state's economy and schools. But now that the parcel is part of the park, Marsh isn't worried about losing trail access for snowshoes and skis. It's less clear if other uses, like biking, will still be allowed under new federal ownership. Chip Jenkins is the superintendent of Grand Teton National Park. He's been out on the parcel hundreds of times and says he frequents it as a skier in the winter and a hiker in the summer. He says the sale...
From the moment that I arrived here, this has been amongst our highest priorities of things to be able to work on.
He says only now, after the sale, can the park start to consider specific uses. However, Jenkins did say the park has a different focus.
Our top priority is having it managed as a place that is preserved for wildlife.
The park will set specifics in the coming months, likely to resemble other areas of the park. Hunting and grazing leases are the only guarantees set by the state in the sale agreement. Activities, Jenkins says, have been allowed in areas since the park's creation, but are subject to change. The Kelly Parcel sold way above market price, a $100 million price tag set by lawmakers. The feds paid about $62 million, the land's appraised value, and the remaining $38 million was fundraised in about a year by the Grand Teton National Park Foundation. That money now sits in a fund for state public schools. The seemingly big environmental win, expanding the national park, is also indirectly linked to oil and gas production. Governor Mark Gordon has indicated the state may spend even more, up to $162 million, to buy energy-rich land in Wyoming's northeast and in the southwest.
We're going to go about it in a very deliberate and conscientious way. And it is not to remove them from public access.
A spokesperson for the Bureau of Land Management said that if specific land is identified, then the BLM would consider selling, per the formal process. That process, once initiated, will likely take several years and involves gathering public input. For some environmentalists, it's unclear how migration paths in exchange for more oil and gas leases impacts the legacy of a historic land deal. Back at the Kelly Parcel, following a pause to listen to coyotes, Susan Marsh is similarly unsure.
You know, I don't like to sacrifice one place for the benefit of some other place, you know.
For now, she's just feeling grateful for the wildlife she's watching.
Well, let's see. We saw bison tracks, elk, I think a coyote. It wasn't new.
Marsh plans to continue making trips to the now federal Shangri-La again, whenever it feels right. Dante Fopula Inkney, KHOL News.
Eagles, ravens, songbirds, elk and deer.
Up next, the mysterious case of Pinedale's Red Lake. This is Open Spaces.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. A beloved fishing lake near Pinedale now has no fish, and the entire lake turned red. That's right, a deep maroon red. And land managers and biologists don't really know why, though they think it might have something to do with toxic algae blooms of cyanobacteria, which has been a growing problem in Wyoming's waters. Reporting on all of this is WyoFile's Mike Koshmerl. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan about the Red Lake and if this is part of a larger trend with warming weather.
Hey, Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Caitlin, happy to be joining you.
So, Mike, the lake in question is Little Soda Lake, just north of Pinedale. And I actually grew up here and I remember people loving fishing there. But as you reported, it hasn't had fish in it for the last few years. Let's start there.
Yeah, Caitlin. So Little Soda Lake is a kind of unique lake in the area because it doesn't have any inflow or outflow for that matter. It's a lake that would naturally be fishless. So the only reason it's been a fishery is that Game and Fish would stock it with trout. But a couple years ago, the local fisheries biologist, Pete Cavalli, he went to like do recon ahead of stocking it and basically noticed that it smelled like, in his words, manure. And it was like pretty potent. He thought, who's going to want to fish in a lake that smells like this? And they made the call not to stock it that year. They also then didn't stock it in 2024. And then in 2024, things took a turn for the worse.
So a couple months ago, it sounds like the lake literally turned red. In your reporting, you included these photos that, honestly, Mike, they kind of looked like out of a sci-fi movie. There's like a snowy sagebrush landscape with Pinedale's Fremont Lake in the distance, looking a normal blue. And then in the forefront is this iced over, deep red Little Soda Lake. Like, we're talking the color of a glass of red wine almost. How did this happen? What's going on here?
Yeah, so that's the great mystery. All the agencies that are looking into it don't really know with certainty. So my understanding is in November, a hunter reported it to the Game and Fish Department. And then they cued in, you know, Bridger Teton National Forest. That's where the lake is actually located. And then those agencies started working with the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. The theories are essentially there's been a long-term drought caused by climate change. Water levels have dropped. It could be related to the strain of cyanobacteria, which might have all died and then just created this color. But like the short story is like they just don't know. They're going to be doing a lot of testing in 2025.
The color change happened relatively quickly, right? We both live here in Pinedale and we both like to recreate out there. And we never noticed the red color like in September and October.
I went hiking there last summer and threw sticks in the lake for my dog. And it was clearly heavily used by cattle. It was like a little beat up, the area, but like it didn't look like some environmental catastrophe had occurred. Even into the fall, it was just looked pretty, kind of nasty water, not something I'd be stoked to get into, but didn't look like something out of a sci-fi movie. And then just in November, which is really kind of odd, you know, usually cyanobacteria and big blooms, they occur in warm weather, fed by nutrients. And when the water cools down, usually, like those kind of issues clear up. But in this situation, it was the opposite. One thing that really stands out to me is just the remarkable turnaround of the historical times, the 60s, 70s, 80s. I've read accounts of people, you know, catching trout out of it and loving this little body of water. And it's just kind of astonishing to me that now it's like this like red colored cesspool that cannot possibly contain populations of fish.
Do you know why it's hard for biologists to kind of figure out what's going on?
I think that they need to do a lot of different tests that just take time. And so they have to get samples of the cyanobacteria and then keep those samples alive in order to test the toxicity. And then also, I think that this is not a normal thing. So I talked to Jill McMurray at the Bridger-Teton National Forest, And she said she had bounced it off like 15 or 20 hydrologists, and they were just drawing blanks. And so you just got to test until you figure it out.
Mike, I know you've reported in the past about harmful cyanobacteria blooms. Have you ever heard of them presenting as red before?
I guess that it's possible, some experts say, but it's not normal for that strain of cyanobacteria. I wouldn't call this the backcountry, but it's relatively pristine on National Forest. I've done some reporting on there being issues in the Brooks Lake watershed off of Togedy Pass. Man, these lakes look just picturesque, and they have had really, really high concentrations of cyanobacteria. You wouldn't want your pet or livestock to be in that water. I mean, it could be very lethal to them. So I think that there's an increased awareness, and so there's more testing, and so we're finding more of these things. There also could be environmental change that's increasing the prevalence, and the Department of Environmental Quality, they have a really handy website where you can see where all the known blooms are in the state of Wyoming. And it's a great tool to just keep yourself and your pets safe, especially. I've had a dog get very, very sick from drinking water out of a algae-choked pond.
Really?
He was so sick, he couldn't even stand up. I mean, I had to carry him into the vet. You know, there's been documented occasions of dogs dying in places where you just wouldn't guess that it's an issue.
What should people be looking for?
So I think that oftentimes the water does look kind of nasty. There'll be a mat of algae. In instances where the water might be more clear, there'll be like things that look like grass clippings floating.
And then circling back to the Red Lake, Little Soda Lake, should people be worried about their drinking water quality in Pinedale? I mean, Fremont isn't that far away where Pinedale's water comes from.
I have not heard anything that would call into question the safety of Pinedale's drinking water.
Do we know if Little Soda is red right now?
I don't know. I do know that after it iced over, it stayed red, which is just weird to me. But that was in December, and it's hard to get to because there's a winter closure around an elk feed ground. I don't know if it's still red. I guess we will find out in the spring when the closure ends and we can easily get in there again.
Yeah, Mike Kosmeral, he reports on wildlife and natural resource issues for Wildfile. We'll post a link to his reporting on Little Soda Lake's decline, and we'll also post a link to that DEQ website as well, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Mike, thanks for speaking with us.
Of course, Caitlin. Thanks.
Tom Kelly is part of a wave of new lawmakers who will be heading to the state capitol soon for the legislative session. He's a university professor in Sheridan, and he joins a supermajority of Republicans in the state house. Kelly talked with Wyoming Public Radio's state house and government reporter, Chris Clements, about the ins and outs of preparing to lead as a rookie policymaker.
Representative Mark Jennings, who has been in this seat for a decade and represented the district well, and I became friends with over the years, was thinking of running for the Senate, and he wanted somebody he said he could trust to take his place in House District 30. So he asked me to run, even though I had emphatically stated that I'm not a politician. I'm not a public official. I'm a long-haired biker. I'm an introvert. I'm not made for this. So considering people in my community, including my representative, had asked me to step up, I asked my family about it, and I have adult children and younger children too. And my wife and my family were very emphatic that this is where I belonged and this is what I should do. And my opponent, Gail Simmons, then announced shortly after that and decided to run against me. And from there, it has been a very pleasant experience that voters I've talked to have been incredibly supportive. The ones who even said they were not voting for me, the ones I disagreed with, we had great conversations and we discussed things along the lines that, like, despite the fact that my opponent's sign is in your yard, I'd still like to get to know you. People took well to that attitude. Press has been surprisingly fair, even-handed with me. I've had no complaints from any news with any news organizations I've been with about being misrepresented or anything.
I understand that there was recently sort of a legislators training week. What has that been like for you?
That is the nuts and bolts of how things work down in the Capitol building. They showed us where the rooms are, how we do things with security, the people in LSO and who we'd work with, where we meet in certain places. We got to meet with the governor, parliamentary procedure, how the House rules work, since, you know, I'll be in the House, but we did it for the Senate too. We did a mock session where we used the parliamentary procedures. So it was really just the nuts and bolts of how things function down there.
What committees have you been assigned to this session? And are you excited about any of them in particular?
Yes, yes. I had specifically asked leadership if it was okay to be on the education committee, because I'm a lifelong educator. I've been a public school teacher, a college professor, a university department head. So thankfully, they put me on the education committee. But the pleasant surprise was also being put on the judiciary committee, which my PhD is in government, American government. And so I do have some background in that, but I don't have any background as an attorney. So that one caused a little more trepidation.
In particular, do you have any concerns or worries for this upcoming session?
My primary worry is how well my family functions when I'm out of town for a while. My youngest son does have Down syndrome, and you know, like leaving him out of town away from him. That's one of my primary concerns. As a legislator, my biggest concern right now is how well I will perform and how well I will represent the constituents and the people who put their faith in me.
When you were doing these mock trials and just all these events before the session, obviously you're a Republican representative. What's the atmosphere been like, I suppose, between members of the other party and the other side of the aisle? Has everything just been more or less collegial?
So far, everything appears to be functioning as one big family, where we'll maybe get in some arguments over the dinner table, but we're still a family. That's kind of how it's presented. But sometimes my social perception can be off because I'm autistic. So I have to take things like that at face value. If everybody's smiling, I'll assume everyone's happy. So that can be a challenge for me, but obviously I've learned how to navigate the world as I am. So my perception, you might find, might be a little bit different than others you talk to.
And you were talking to me earlier before I was recording about how you're from Colorado as well. Could you talk to me just a bit about what you were saying in terms of people, in your own words, sort of misrepresenting maybe the fact that you're from another state and now are a legislator in Wyoming?
Ah, yes. Well, I'm originally from Illinois, and Illinois was a sinking ship 20 years ago. I decided I could not raise my kids there. I have 6 children. We moved to Greeley, Colorado. Weld County is a red conservative county, or it was when we moved there. The political nature of Colorado changed drastically in a very short period. They're the first state to legalize marijuana, and then they instituted mail-in ballots, and the state just became a tidal wave of blue after that. The policies that were enacted were gun control, higher taxes, an ever-growing state, further state intrusion into family life. It was all the things that made us leave Illinois: rising crime, rising taxes. And so we moved to Wyoming because it was the Western culture, very similar to what Colorado used to be, of community, faith, family, and a state that is there to do the basics of public goods and have a functioning society without becoming an overbearing, overtaxing entity. So one of the things I had noticed having moved to Wyoming, where I thought I was going to finally get to just lead a quiet life and take care of my kids, because Wyoming's culture is very much live and let live, was that I started to see some of the same political narratives I had heard in Illinois 20 years ago, that I heard in Colorado 10 years ago. And I started speaking out to people saying, I've seen this before.
I've already asked you in the past, and you let me know that you don't intend to join the Freedom Caucus. But I mean, how has that dynamic, the fact that they are going to control the levers of power in Cheyenne, how has that dynamic been for you so far? Or has it even been noticeable so far?
Well, technically speaking, the Wyoming Freedom Caucus in the House is in the minority. There are more non-Freedom Caucus members than there are Freedom Caucus members. Now, what we typically see in the media is that they say Freedom Caucus aligned, because there are people like me who are actually endorsed by the Freedom Caucus, even though I'm not a member and I've told them I have no intention of joining. I haven't noticed nearly as much division now that the election's over as I did during the campaign season. But that can very well change once we actually get into session. And maybe it's just the calm before the storm, but right now I'm not seeing clear divisions between Wyoming caucus, Freedom Caucus, or even the Democrats for that matter.
Happy to be able to talk with you, Representative Kelly, and I will be reaching out again soon.
All right, well, thanks.
That was a conversation between Sheridan Representative Tom Kelly and WPR's state government reporter, Chris Clements. Confused by how bills get made in Wyoming? We've got you covered. Stick around for the Cheyenne Roundup, coming up next on Open Spaces.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. This winter, Wyoming Public Radio is teaming up with WyoFile to bring you weekly updates from the legislative session. It's called the Cheyenne Roundup, and you can hear it here on Open Spaces or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly look at Wyoming's legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and WyoFile. I'm Maggie Mullen, WyoFile's state government and politics reporter, and with me is Jordan Uplinger, Wyoming Public Radio's new digital state government reporter.
Thanks for having me, Maggie. With the legislators' general session just days away, we're going to lay out how things work over in Cheyenne. This year is a general session, which means that lawmakers will be looking at a bunch of bills that cover a range of topics, from agriculture to technology to taxes to education, policy bills. It's a 40-day long session with a flurry of activity about halfway through, when bills need to go from one chamber to the other. And we'll see that flurry again in the final days of the session. Right now, we're seeing over 200 bill drafts posted to the website. However, Governor Mark Gordon suggested that there's more than 600 bill drafts that have been submitted, an increase from what he's seen in his tenure.
And there's the supplemental budget, which the legislature, they work on that during odd-numbered years. And it's meant to address emergencies and unanticipated needs between budget sessions. And on top of all that, the Wyoming Freedom Caucus has this ambitious plan to pass what they say are 5 key bills in the first 10 days of the session. It includes legislation to restrict the voter registration process, to prohibit diversity, equity, and inclusion programming in higher education, and a property tax relief bill vetoed by Governor Mark Gordon last year. And they're calling it the Five and Dime Plan.
Right. The Five and Dime Plan. 5 bills passed in the first 10 days. And additionally, they have something called the 2020 Vision, which is the next 15 bills they want to pass in the first 20 days. But before we move forward, I think it's important to mention the last primary saw only 27% of the voting age population went to the polls. More voters did turn out for the general, but nonetheless, there might be some listeners asking, who's the Freedom Caucus? Can you talk about their significance, Maggie?
Yeah. So the Freedom Caucus is a group of hardline Republicans in the House. They formed the group in 2020 to challenge Republican leadership. And since then, they've acted as the further right opposition party at the state house. But now they're in the majority, thanks to the 2024 elections. So they'll control the House. And they've also got a lot of allies in the Senate.
So we're likely to see at least some political maneuverings and showdowns this session. But I want to go back to what you said a little earlier, that the Five and Dime plan is ambitious.
Yes, it is. And here's why that is. So the simple answer is lawmaking takes time. It just does. Plus, lawmakers already work with a set of formal deadlines. Bills need to be introduced by a certain date to pass, for example. They also need committee approval, just to name a couple of those hoops. So to bring self-imposed deadlines into the mix ups the ante for lawmakers. There is at least one advantage the Five and Dime plan has as far as its chances of moving along smoothly. Most of the five bills included in the plan are familiar territory for lawmakers.
Right. And they're familiar because not all bills start from scratch. So, for example, one of the bills in the Five and Dime plan for homeowner property tax exemption, that's coming out of the Joint Revenue Committee. It was vetoed by Governor Gordon last year, but lawmakers still want it and believe they have a chance this time with control of the House. So here's the significance of bills sponsored by joint committees. At the end of the session, lawmakers can request bill topics. These topics get assigned to joint interim committees. Those joint interim committees meet during the off season. Committees spend roughly 6 months researching, gathering opinions from the public and experts, often interviewing people for hours, then workshopping details of these bills. Bills from these committees kind of have a head start coming into the session because they've already been vetted. Usually, they get significant consideration at the very least.
Totally. That said, there's 26 brand new lawmakers. There's 23 in the House and 3 in the Senate. And that will absolutely slow things down in the House. There's just no way around that learning curve. Plus, the Freedom Caucus, they've shown us before that they're not always willing to prioritize committee bills in the way the legislature traditionally has. We saw that in the 2024 session. In fact, committee bills failed on introduction in the 2024 session at higher rates than ever before. And introduction is just the beginning of the process that a bill must go through during session to become a law.
Right. There's a lot of steps, but let's take the ESG bill or Environmental Social Governance Investments bill as an example. That's a bill that they tried in 2023. That was also vetoed by the governor. Now with House control, the Wyoming Freedom Caucus says that they have a mandate, so they're trying that again. But it's coming from a group of right-wing lawmakers, not a committee. So what's that process? Well, simply put, you have paperwork first, debate second, and the governor's desk third. The paperwork is drafting a bill with formatting and terminology input from the Legislative Service Office and sending it to the State House. The Legislative Service Office, or LSO, is a bunch of lawyers and staff of the legislature that really keeps the wheels on this bus just moving forward.
Plus, the LSO works with state agencies to put together an estimate of how much a bill will cost or how much revenue it'll bring in. And these fiscal notes, they can be really informative. Other times, there are just too many variables, and LSO is unable to come up with an estimate.
Right. So back to a bill making its wayward journey towards becoming law. It's introduced in one chamber, a clerk will read the bill, and the presiding officer will refer it to committee.
And just to be clear, these committees are split along chamber lines during the session. For example, members of the Joint Education Committee, they split into a Senate panel and a House panel. Now, when these committees meet to discuss and take action on a bill, that's the one opportunity for the public to weigh in during session. So that's when folks can testify, they can give lawmakers input. But as far as what action a committee can take, that really varies. So a committee can amend a bill, it can vote to kill a bill, it can table a bill, and of course, a committee can send a bill to its chamber for a full floor debate. And that's where first, second, and third reading come into play. And a lot can happen at that point too. Lawmakers, again, they can amend the bill, or leadership can prioritize that legislation. They can also bury it under a bunch of other bills.
If it passes, the bill goes to the other chamber and the whole process starts over.
And if the second chamber makes changes to a bill that the first chamber just doesn't like, that's when you'll see what's called a joint conference committee. So that's a panel of lawmakers who is responsible for negotiating a unified version of the bill that both the House and the Senate will agree to. And if they succeed, the bill then heads to the governor's desk. And depending on the timing of that, the governor has a few choices. He can sign it, he can veto it, or he can let it become law without his signature.
And the legislator can overrule a veto if two-thirds of all lawmakers across both chambers vote for it. That back and forth could be interesting to watch this year. But for right now, Maggie, you've been at this for a while. What are you watching for this session?
Well, Jordan, you know, there's a few things I'm gonna be keeping my eye on. For one, it's always an interesting time in the People's House, and that's a good reminder for those listening that while committee meetings are the only time during session where you can formally weigh in on bills to lawmakers, the Capitol is open to the public, and folks can come down at any time and speak to lawmakers, and I always encourage them to do so. But as far as what I'll be watching, I'm very interested to see what happens with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. They have always been the opposition party or the minority party, however you want to call it, but they've now taken control. And I think that, we'll see some different kind of political maneuvering, some different kind of political branding from them. I mean, they now have to govern. So I'm very eager to see what that looks like, especially because the Wyoming State House is the first in the country to see a Freedom Caucus take over. So eager to have a front row seat to that. I also follow a lot of election related matters. So I'm interested to see how a lot of these election related bills do. You know, Secretary of State Chuck Gray has had his eye on a lot of these, such as banning drop boxes and, you know, upping the ante for the voter ID requirements. And those bills have a better shot than they have had in quite a while. So I'll be keeping my eye on that. Jordan, this is your first rodeo. So what's catching your attention?
Well, since it's my first time doing all of this, everything's catching my attention. But I'm also interested in how the Freedom Caucus will govern. And I think that anyone who's optimistic or extremely concerned about this new incoming federal administration, I think they can look to Wyoming as maybe a testbed for some conservative policies that they might try to push on the federal level. Additionally, I'll also be watching Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, blockchains. Wyoming wants to have its own stable token this year, so that'll be interesting. And there's also a Senate joint resolution to call a convention of states, essentially a constitutional convention, something that Democrats and Republicans have both tried to call for different reasons over the past few decades. But this time around, there's a small chance that Wyoming passing this convention could add to a growing movement, and we actually see a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution. But right now, just watching that five and dime plan, so.
Thanks for that, Jordan. And thanks for listening to the Cheyenne Roundup, your weekly look at what lawmakers are up to during the 2025 legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and WildFile. New episodes drop every Friday throughout the session. Editing and producing by Tennessee Watson, Camila Kudelska, and Nikki Ouellette. Follow our ongoing legislative coverage at wyomingpublicmedia.org and wildfile.com. And thanks again for listening.
Open Spaces will be back with the Cheyenne Roundup on January 24th, but you can find it every Friday, late afternoon, on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, the story of how Wyoming came to celebrate the nation's first female governor. This is Open Spaces.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Welcome back to Open Spaces. January 5th was the 100th anniversary of the inauguration of the nation's first female governor, Wyoming's own Nellie Taylor Ross. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska asked historian Kylie McCormick who Ross was.
She was an ambitious woman in a time where ambition was not a valued trait in women. So she was born in St. Joseph, Missouri during Reconstruction, 1876. Her family had been slaveholders. They had a large plantation and they came to financial ruin after the Civil War. And so she was raised in poverty and her family selling off bits of the farm in order to try and keep up with their back taxes. She experiences hard work at a really young age. Her mother was also contributing to the household and that there was really economic equality between her mother and father. She had graduated high school. She worked as a piano teacher in Omaha, Nebraska before becoming a kindergarten teacher. And while visiting family in Paris, Tennessee, she met her future husband, William B. Ross, who moved to Wyoming in 1901.
So who was William Ross?
He was politically ambitious. He was a Democrat. He ran for office several times, mostly unsuccessfully, some very close races. And it's finally the Teapot Dome scandal that happens in 1922 that makes people very suspicious of Republicans and gets a lot of wins nationally for Democrats, including here in Wyoming. And that's the race that William Ross, he wins that race. And unfortunately, in his term, he had a terrible case of appendicitis and passes away in October 1924.
How does she become governor? How does that happen?
Yes, it was a very difficult decision. Her family was telling her that she probably shouldn't run. I think that there's two things that really motivate her to decide to go ahead and run. And one of it is that she wanted to carry on her husband and his legacy and the what he was trying to implement as governor. And the other was that she was ambitious. She wanted the job. That being First Lady of Wyoming, she had a taste of politicking. And I think that she had a vision for what she could do in that position. And she had some things that she wanted to get done for the state. So she does end up running.
At the time, Wyoming was already known as a quality state. So can you explain if you think that helped or at all with Ross's success?
I think that it did. There were some of her surrogates that really made that point that how great it would be with Wyoming being the equality state, the first to recognize women's right to vote, also electing the nation's first woman governor. It's not necessarily an argument that she embraced. She said, this is a quote that she gives later on in her life to People's Magazine in the 1970s, she said, "I've always thought candidates for public office should not be chosen on the basis of sex. Being a woman should not mitigate for or against someone."
What did she do during her tenure? What were her priorities? What were the things that she was trying to promote?
There were three of her husband's policies that she wanted to carry on. She wanted to continue spending cuts, is something that he had tried to accomplish while he was in office. He also wanted to provide state loans for farmers and ranchers and a strong enforcement of prohibition. Then she also had eight other additional things that she was trying to do. She wanted cities, counties, and school districts to have budgets and to operate under budgets. She also wanted to earmark state mineral royalties for school districts and improve safety for coal miners, as well as protecting women in industrial jobs.
And did she succeed with any of those?
She succeeded with a couple of them, and a few of them we see implemented later on in Wyoming that didn't get implemented in her term. And some of the things that she did work against her that the stronger enforcement of prohibition, she ends up firing a few people in her cabinet. And that comes back to bite her when it comes time for re-election.
Did she champion anything else that today we would say are women issues?
I think that prohibition was strongly associated with women and women's rights. And when we think about prohibition today, we forget really the context from which that emerged. It really started as a women's rights movement and a fight against domestic violence. That's really at the heart of prohibition, is trying to cut down on domestic violence.
She does ultimately lose her own run as governor, but at that point she had become pretty famous, as I understand. So what did she do with her career after?
In 1928, during the presidential election, she campaigns on behalf of the Democrat nominee, Al Smith. He loses that campaign to Herbert Hoover, but it really puts Nellie Taylor Ross in this prominent position in the National Democratic Committee. And so they offer her the salaried position of director of the women's division for them. And she runs the campaign for the women's vote for Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he runs for office. When he wins that seat in 1933, he names her as director of the U.S. Mint. She's the first woman to ever hold that role as director of the U.S. Mint. She serves a total of 20 years, and that's the longest serving director, period, man or woman.
So we're at the 100-year anniversary, and we have not had another woman governor. I guess just thinking of her impact leading the way for women in Wyoming 100 years later, where do you think we are with that?
There's a couple of different ways to look at the story of equality in Wyoming. There's a very negative way of, we did not live up to our founding ideals, that right when we were a territory, the first legislative session passed not only the law recognizing women's right to vote and hold office, but also an equal pay clause, which we have one of the worst pay gaps in the nation today. They also passed rights for women to have rights to their children, which was very unique at the time. And we also passed laws that recognized married women's right to hold property. And we can see, oh, that's something that we failed to reach that goal. And it kind of gives this impression of, well, what's the point of even trying? But there's also a positive way to look at this, and that is by looking at that history and looking at people like Nellie Taylor Ross, and we can see them as inspirations. We can also see how hard they worked to make this happen and to establish this identity in Wyoming, and say, well, what are we going to do for our generation to continue our identity as the equality state? How can we strive to live up to these founding ideals? And I think that's a much more positive way to read this story and be inspired by it.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with historian Kylie McCormick about the legacy of the nation's first female governor, Nellie Taylor Ross. Students in Green River High School's senior government class wrote a proclamation to make January 5th Nellie Taylor Ross Day in honor of the 100th anniversary of her swearing in. The class sent their proclamation to Governor Mark Gordon, who signed it on December 20th. This is the story of how the day came to be.
Whereas 100 years ago, Nellie Taylor Ross, a trailblazer in American politics, made profound contributions to the advancement of women in leadership and public service, and holds the distinguished honor of being the first female governor in the history of the United States, and whereas her inauguration as the 14th governor of Wyoming.
Okay, I'm Bridget Nielsen. I teach at Green River High School Social Studies, and one of my classes is senior government. So I am on the Sweetwater Historical Museum Foundation Board, and our museum director actually was looking at events that happened in 2025, and he realized that it was the 100th anniversary of the inauguration of Nellie Taylor Ross, the first woman governor of Wyoming and, of course, in the United States. And he said, we should write a proclamation to celebrate that. And I said, I teach senior government. Could my students possibly do that, you know, take lead? They were like, who could do that? And I was like, me, my students will do that. And they were like, awesome. And so I brought it back to my class and I just said, hey, guys, this important anniversary is coming up. And I kind of just explained what a proclamation is, a day you get to celebrate and honor something. The governor will sign it. And it just goes down as an important day in history to be celebrated. Would you guys like to be a part of this? And they were such good sports this year and said, of course.
My name is Elena Apperson. I'm a senior at Green River High School, and we wrote a proclamation for my senior government class.
All right. I'm Keegan Gailey. I'm a senior in high school, and I was in Ms. Nielsen's senior government class. Me personally, I was a little iffy about whether it would fail or if it would pass, because in my mind, like, learning about senior government and the whole government system, like, little people, we get a little bit of a voice, but we don't get to make holidays and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I was also pretty iffy at first because my class, and we're not as serious, I would say. We can be, but I didn't know how my class would do with it. So Ms. Nielsen had us all take a few minutes, do a lot of research, and we each wrote one whereas statement with what we thought was the most important and needed to be recognized.
I personally thought it was really amazing just how many walls she broke for women. Like, at that time, a woman being the governor was just completely unheard of, and she didn't care. She just went right ahead with it.
I felt that it was really amazing to see that a woman could do so much in that time. Never once did it, like, mention that she could have been scared or nervous about anything. And I feel like nowadays you just hear about how scary it can be to do things as a woman. With such, like, that holds such value and power. And then Ms. Nielsen took all of those whereas statements, fixed them up a little, and then she presented it to the class and asked if we wanted to make any changes or we felt something was missing. And then that's how the proclamation came to be.
We had the governor actually come and sign and show us the proclamation. We all shook hands with the governor. It was really amazing.
I will say, though, it was really emotional. I did start crying a few times. And seeing, like, what we did as a class do something was really emotional as well.
I personally think that it's, like, a big step forward just for my career in general. Like, it's the first time in my life that I've truly been treated like an adult. It just made me feel like I can actually do things in this world. Like, I can think this Sunday is our holiday. It's something that I put forward. And I think that's just really good and really groundbreaking for me.
You know, I've always kind of been interested in government, but I never felt I could do it or it was something for me. But, like, being able to really be a part of it shows me that maybe I could be.
And I call upon all citizens to honor and celebrate the life and legacy of this remarkable woman whose trailblazing efforts have paved the way for countless others in varying roles of government and leadership. I affix the seal on the 20th day of December.
That was Green River High School seniors and their teacher recounting how they made January 5th Nellie Taylor Ross Day. The story was produced by Camila Kadelska. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our audio and digital producer today, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.